Welcome to the Velo News Podcast. I'm Spencer Paulson, coming to you from Colorado here with Chris Case and Dane Cash. How are you guys doing today?
Doing excellent, good. Excellent.
We are sitting around our horrible, annoying desk we have here in the basement of Velo News. There's all these legs that get in the way. Someday we'll get a nice card table to more comfortably podcast, but we're going to suffer through it today because that's what cycling's all about, suffering.
At least we have this nice foam.
We got some foam that helps with the sound dampening. I'm sure you guys can notice the audio quality. It's really
stellar.
Exceptional.
Oh, yeah, excellent.
Exceptional. But no, we're not here to talk about that garbage. We're here to talk about the Tour of Utah. And Dane, you were on the ground in Utah covering the entire race last week. And you look like you got a nice tan out there.
I did. I got a lot of sun out there. Although I also got some smoke. There's a fair bit of smoke in the Salt Lake City area this week, which is
wildfires, not other kind of smoke.
Yeah, that's correct. Yes. Coming from fires on mountainsides and such. And it did. I think it did affect the racing a little bit, but most of the days were fine and sunny and lovely and lovely Utah people. It was a great race all around, I gotta say.
Did you get yourself a cowboy hat?
I did not, although I did get myself a cool trucker hat, some swag from the race, which I have worn every day up until today, actually.
Wow.
So, yeah, how about that?
Such a hipster.
Yeah, that's me.
Such a hipster.
Yeah.
So the Tour of Utah is it's billed as America's toughest race. You guys have both covered it, Chris. You and Dana both covered it.
A couple of times.
Yep. I mean, is that for real? Is it actually America's toughest race?
I've never raced it, but I think that it's always proves to be really challenging. They've got those classic stages up to Snowbird and the one in Park City that goes up Empire Pass and Guardsman Pass. And those are, I've ridden that stuff and it is heavy surfaces and steep climbs and it is brutal. And it gets hot out there and some of those stages you go through a lot of windy areas. Yeah, I'd say it's up there as one of the toughest races in the U.S.
Yeah, it certainly seemed like it this year. I mean, the parkour this year was very tailored to the climbers. There was nominally a time trial, but it was the shortest time trial I have ever covered in person. It was all of 5 kilometers and did not last very long, which is good because it was 105 degrees that day.
Ooh.
Yeah, not that pleasant.
Nasty.
Very much so. Not a lot of riders coming off the buses to chat with folks like me. Surprising. I don't know why they wouldn't want to come out and
chat. But you're so charming.
I know, right? Yeah. Otherwise, yeah, a lot of really good climber days and a lot of opportunities for a bunch of different guys to show how good they are at climbing, even though really it was kind of one guy showing how good he was at climbing.
Mm.
But we can get a little bit later
when
we get
that
to
later.
That. Yeah.
So it is America's toughest race.
I think so.
I mean, I'm kind of a little doubtful because I got dropped in the local office park crit a few weeks ago, so I'm pretty sure that's going to be the toughest race in America. And those guys are just going to have to come out and prove themselves in that race to really actually, you know, make it clear that it
absolutely
is.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like you could have definitely mixed it up there on snowbirds.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Maybe on the old stump jumper?
Yes, I could do that. Yes. Little shout out to my Leadville adventure last week. You check that out on velonews.com. I was riding a 1983 stump jumper in the Leadville Trail 100 mountain bike race. It was awesome. Super fun. But we're not here to talk too much about that because, Tour of Utah was a pretty big race. I mean, I don't know if I would say it's entirely exciting, but Dane, I'd love to hear your takes on some of the biggest things that were going on that week. Who are the riders? Who are the, you know, what were the themes throughout the week? You were there on the ground. Give it to us. Let's hear about what it was like on the ground in Utah.
Well, before we even get to the racing, I feel like the atmosphere was really enjoyable at the race. I mean, there were fans on the road for many of the key moments and the big finishes, which was really nice to see out of the Tour of Utah. Although the weather was hot, we had pretty clear days than the smoke, so that was also really good. And I thought the course design, I mean, I was very impressed. I think it really lent itself to having some exciting stages. So all of that kind of stuff to set up a good race was there. And then the racing itself was very entertaining if you were a fan of American riders.
Mm-hmm.
There were 7 stages. 6 of them were won by Americans, as was the overall race, which I think the Tour of Utah has got to be happy about, because people who are at the roadside of the Tour of Utah, they're going to be rooting for the Americans. I mean, sure, there might be a stray Sergei Tvetkov fan out there.
He's basically an American.
That's right. He lives
in
Colorado, I think. So he basically is, yeah.
And has for many years.
Right, right. But we had a lot of fans out there rooting for the American riders, and they were very pleased, I think, to get a lot of stage winners, a lot of, you know, fan favorites just showing themselves every day. And we had a lot of pretty popular riders in the breakaways too. So it was really good, I think, for, like I said, for American fans to see just results all week long for those guys.
And backing up for a sec, when you're talking about the race course design, I assume what you mean is that there was kind of a nice little mountain stage early on in the Mount Nebo stage that helped to sort of spice things up early, create a little hierarchy in the GC, and then you go back to a few of the sprinter stages before the real decisive days on the final two stages.
Exactly. I tend to get pretty bored when I watch a race that has one decisive day really early on or at the end, because then you're either stuck with no changes early or nothing until the very end of the race. We didn't have that this year, which is really nice. And then the other thing was the Nebo climb. While it was not the final climb of that stage, it was a really decisive climb, and it made for a really exciting finish there on that day, which even though it was a downhill into the finish, and that kind of shows that you don't have to necessarily have a summit finish to have exciting racing. I know a lot of people, you look at the Vuelta profiles, for instance, and you say, oh, well, there's only four or five summit finishes, but a lot of times you can get a lot of exciting racing if you put a climb 20K out, just depending on the riders themselves.
Mm-hmm. And Chris, what do you think? How did this year's route compare to the years in the past that you've gone and covered the race?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was there at least once. So I believe Lachlan Morton has won a couple stages in Utah, and he won the overall 2016. Definitely. I was there the year he attacked at the base of Nebo. He was on Garmin at the time, and climbed away from everybody and descended into Payson and took the win solo. So that stage is reminiscent. And then the last two stages this year are reminiscent, and they've started. They try to make it a true tour of Utah and have it cover a lot of the state. So you start way down in St. George and you're near Cedar City and then you traverse up through some of the scenic areas. And I think that this year was pretty similar, but there's always slight variations there that bring some originality to the route. So that was interesting.
I think they've definitely found something good with the Snowbird and the Park City finishes too. Those days were pretty decisive.
I mean, you can't, they happen every year and you just, they're such amazing days on the bike, and the fans going up the Little Cottonwood Canyon to Snowbird. They know what to expect, but it's always a great show every year, and something always dramatic happens there.
I'm more of a Park City guy than I am a Snowbird guy when it comes to comparing those two stages. I find that the Snowbird finish is just that classic Mountain West engineered roadway that's just
Not as intimate rugged as Empire Pass.
It's more of a highway, and it doesn't provoke the same sort of exciting racing, but man, we've had some days on Empire Pass when it's just totally blown up. I'm thinking of the day when Lachlan Morton attacked to win the overall. That was just to
take out Talansky.
Masterful. Yeah, that was a very exciting day of racing. We didn't quite see that this year, but Dane,
we didn't need to.
That's true, we didn't need to. Dane, tell me some more about the race.
Well, I think referencing Morton is it's good, because this year there are some similarities, I think, with the years past, where just like Morton, I mean, the guys you saw in the top five, the top 10 even this year, none of them were massive surprises. There were no, you know, sprinters suddenly in the GC top 10. There were no huge surprises. But a couple of the pre-race favorites weren't there. And that was a little bit surprising. Some of those guys just didn't have the weeks that people expected of them. I mean, TJ Van Garderen went out and won the prologue, and he looked fine the first couple of days, but then he lost a bunch of time.
That actually stunned me.
That he won the prologue coming off the tour.
Coming off the tour and a few weird days and travel and to come out. And in a time trial, that definitely does not suit him.
No.
You know, like he's a good time trialist, but not a prologue guy.
Yeah.
Too short.
Yeah.
And the heat as
stunner,
well. Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
Well, good for him.
And that set him and his team up. I mean, people thought, because they had all three guys in the top three on that stage. Everybody was thinking that BMC was set up to dominate.
Yeah.
And they didn't. They didn't dominate. And then EF, they were trying to ride the race with, I mean, they had a lot of firepower, and they were trying to ride the race to take advantage of that, putting five guys on the front on the climbs and doing what a dominant team would do on the climbs. And then all of a sudden, they were getting attacked and unable to follow. So again, the two big favorite teams coming in, BMC, EF, didn't really deliver. And instead, you got a huge performance from Sepp Kuss.
Yeah.
Hey, Otto Jumbo. Sepp Kuss.
There we go. Yeah. We were leading you on for a while there. And then we finally, boom, right in your face.
The one thing you have to say is, I mean, I really enjoyed this race. I had a great time covering it. I think it was pretty exciting. But Kuss dominated. I mean, it wasn't close at any point. After he showed himself on Mount Nebo, I mean, from there on out, he was clearly the strongest rider in the race. And I think a couple of the journalists in the press room, we were expecting him maybe on stage five and definitely in stage six, play a little more conservatively. He's got the lead. Just take it easy. Roll on into Park City. Sew up the yellow jersey. Nah, he went on the attack, buried everybody 2 days in a row at the end of the race just to really put an exclamation point on the win. And yeah, I mean, he was just dominating, and the kid's only, what, 23 years old, yep. So.
I think he gained a tremendous number of fans at the Tour of Utah because he wasn't conservative.
Right.
He could have been, and he still would have won, but I think being aggressive, kind of throwing it out there, smiling half the time he was doing
it. He was just laughing, and like, it was like, yeah.
Just completely in love with dancing up the mountains, and yeah, we'll get into him a little bit more, but I think he did a great job of building his fan base for sure.
I would agree there.
And you guys say, I think hats off to his team as well. The team did a pretty good job Absolutely. Of putting him in position and sticking with him and you know, chasing the moves when they needed to, but not doing what EF did, which was apparently exert themselves too much.
Yeah,
which
they were pretty patient.
Yeah, it was a pretty impressive job from a relatively young team. I mean, you also had Nielsen Palace there, who is just like Kuss, who's a young American, and some other young guys there as well. And I think they did a really nice job of controlling the race and setting up their guy to crush everybody, despite being so much younger and less experienced than some of these teams like BMC, EF, Trek had some experienced guys there as well.
Yep. Yeah, and I think it's also important for Sepp Kuss to sort of prove himself this way to his team, because it's his first year on this World Tour team. It's a Dutch team. It's, you know, you're still kind of finding your way as a pro cyclist when you enter that sphere. And to show yourself as a true winner, you know, sure, it's an American race. Sure, it's not a World Tour race, but it still is meaningful. And he did it with quite a bit of, you know, decisive panache, like you said, Chris. So a lot of, it's a lot of good points for him there. And it's really amazing, too, for Sepp, because if you look back, you know, not long ago, he was on the Gateway Harley-Davidson Elite Amateur team.
Right.
I think that was just even at the start of 2017, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And then
he's come a long way.
He got picked up. He got picked up by Rally, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, Rally.
And then before you know it, he signs a contract with Lotto NL Jumbo. One of one or two Americans on that team this year, and it's a pretty steep ascent to the World Tour there.
And now he's going to race a Grand Tour.
Exactly.
In just a couple of days here, he's going to the Vuelta. The team kind of spilled the beans on the last day. He was trying to kind of avoid talking about it a little bit.
Well, they didn't spill the beans, Dane. You got the scoop.
Oh, thank you, Spencer.
Yeah. Give yourself a little credit for that.
I appreciate that. Yeah, he was trying to avoid the question. I mean, a couple of us were sort of asking, and he was, and then his DS kind of broke the news there.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal. We were chatting a little bit. Our European correspondent, Andy Hood, was saying that's not something that Lotto NL usually does. Takes a guy that young, neo-pro, to a Grand Tour. That's a big deal that they're taking him. And this is a team with a pretty nice track record of developing talents recently. This is, of course, the same team that developed Primoz Roglic and Dylan Groenewegen in the last 2 years into being GC guys and one of the top sprinters in the sport.
So Steven Krzysztof, too.
Pretty strong track record.
Yeah, definitely. So I got to wonder, you know, this is a huge result, but where does that, what do we think about Sepp Kuss now? Is he on a trajectory here, or is this a one-off? Is he the real deal? That's what I want to know, because I've met him before. I've ridden with him a little bit. Seems like a great guy. I love his attitude. He's a Colorado kid. He came up mountain bike racing, but man, you just look at that type of result and you're like, wow, is this the sign of things to come? Or is this, I just want to know, is he the real deal? And Chris, I feel like you are one of the best people to ask that question of.
I spent a good amount of time riding with him in the past. Trevor Connor and I are a sort of training guru that we have at Velonews here. And I worked with Sepp on a big article last year sort of about the science of climbing. So we did a bunch of time trial tests with him and rode with him. And he was putting up pretty staggering numbers, honestly. We've got this climb here in Boulder called Flagstaff Mountain. It's kind of a testing ground for pros, for amateurs, for pretty much anyone that lives in this area. And we did a time trial up Flagstaff in November. So after his season and before he's really, you know, running hot for the coming season. And he hadn't even signed with Lotto NL yet or announced it. But anyways, he went out there on a November day, a cold November day, and was within 30 seconds, I believe, of the KOM on Strava, which was held by Danielson. Danielson said it right after he came back from the Tour of Utah that year, where there was a little something suspicious going on with the old... we knew, and we now know, he's got an incredible engine. I will say a couple things about that. He didn't show anything this spring when he was riding for Lotto. I shouldn't say anything. He got into the break at Strada Bianchi, and that was a big deal. He ends up finishing the race, and that's he was out there for all day, kind of crappy conditions, and still finishes up. But the rest of his year, I think he's just getting his, typically like a neopro would, getting his head kicked in. But he's got this engine, and I know that when he came back from Europe to train and gear up for tune up for Utah I don't know if he was thinking he was going to do Colorado.
I think he knew about the Vuelta, by the way.
Yeah.
He
probably did. Anyways, he comes back here and he's doing these massive rides and he's back on what he's familiar, his familiar terrain, familiar training. And he comes out and he stomps it and he dominates Tour of Utah like no one else really has in the past. But, and here's the but, you could see his inexperience at the Tour of Utah.
Mm.
That aggressive nature we're talking about, that doesn't necessarily pay off for him at the Vuelta.
Little foolhardy.
Yes. Mm. While it is awesome to watch, and in a week-long stage race when you are competing against a non-Grand Tour caliber field and some guys coming off the tour and all that, he could get away with those tactical mistakes, honestly. Attacking 5 miles from a summit finish on a huge day with one big day left to go, that's not something you would normally do.
Especially if you're in the leader's jersey.
Especially if you're in the leader's jersey. So I think that Sepp is an incredible talent. He's got a lot to learn. I think he would be the first to admit that because he's only been racing on the road for 3 years, really. A lot of mountain bike experience, but that is a very different sport, as we've seen and with other people. It takes them a while to turn that corner and get the road talent and the road skills. So that's sort of my 2 minute long analysis of Sepp. And I have my fingers crossed that he goes to the Vuelta and he is able to at least, complete it. I don't have high expectations that he'll go out and win a couple stages. I mean, that'd be asking a lot of a kid his age in his first Grand Tour.
How old is he again?
He's 23.
He's still very young.
And honestly, he's riding a peak at Utah, and there's a ways between now and the Vuelta start and the Vuelta finish for sure. So,
yeah, we got about 10 days, I think, till it starts.
Yeah. For almost a month before it's over with. So to hold that form physiologically, pretty difficult.
You're getting attacked by Vincenzo Nibali.
Yeah. They've got George Bennett. That team has George Bennett over there, probably as their GC leader. And hopefully Sepp is right there in the mountains with him until he pops.
Just learning. Soaking it all in.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's my hope.
Tell me a little more about Sepp's physiology, Chris. You said his numbers are very, very promising, very good. Where do those relate to kind of in the grand scheme of things as a pro cyclist? Is he above average as a pro cyclist? I presume his greatest advantage is the fact that he's got excellent watts per kilo.
Yeah. I don't know how he compares to other riders because I'm not privy to a lot of riders' numbers and power to weight and watts per kilo figures and things like that. I do know that he has this incredible capacity to go above threshold and then come back. So you could see it in his power profile on a climb like Flagstaff, not in shape in terms of a professional cyclist at that time of year, but he was still able to go well above threshold, 20-30% above threshold, come back below it and work with the terrain of the climb to recover, sort of clear that lactate, and then do it again, and then come back, and then do it again, and come back. So he's got an innate ability, and he does have a background as a Nordic skier, so there could be something to that. He definitely knows how to work with the terrain of a climb. Instead of really pushing the pace on the steepest parts, it's going really hard on the steep parts, but not going overboard. And then when you start to crest the hill, you really use your momentum to launch from there. So he's got good instincts when it comes to climbing. He's got some physiological attributes that help him as a great climber. But I don't know how he compares to others, unfortunately.
Well, it seems like that type of pacing tactic would really pay off on the variable climbs of Europe.
Yes.
Because unlike what I was saying about the snowbird climb, which is a very steady climb, most of the time if you're racing in the Alps, you're racing in the Pyrenees, really any of the terrain apart from maybe like Switzerland, I'd say, it has much of that variability in the ramps and then the switchbacks that provide a brief moment of respite. So it'll be interesting to see how he does in the Vuelta. We'll all be watching that very closely. And like I said, I think we're going to temper our expectations. I think
we should, yeah.
The question of whether Sepkus is the real deal is probably still undecided.
Yeah.
I think we're going to need to give him another year or two. But it is promising to see what he does at the Tour de Utah. And then we're interested to see what he does at the Vuelta. Now, speaking of another climber, one who's really proven herself already, Katie Hall is headed to Bulls Dolmans. She is currently on United Healthcare through the end of the year, winner of the Amgen Tour of California, as well as the Tour of the Gila, as well as Joe Martin stage race this year. She pretty much dominated the domestic scene. So it's big news that this top climber is headed to the biggest women's team in the world, basically. And she will be racing here on our home ground in Colorado at the Colorado Classic, which starts Thursday running through the weekend. And lucky us, we were able to hear from her ahead of the race. Our fearless leader, Fred Dreyer, was down at the opening press conference in Denver, and he was able to spend some time with Katie to talk more about her future, talk more about Bulls Dolmans and what it means. She's a very talented rider, very smart as well, the type of rider who doesn't necessarily have to be a pro cyclist. She could be a professional and go off into the real world and get a job that's actually probably going to pay good money, but she has passion for cycling, and she's very good at it, and she's a great climber, like I said. So here is Fred talking to Katie Hall at the start of the Colorado Classic.
Okay, this is Fred Dreyer. You're listening to the L News Podcast, and I'm joined right now by Katie Hall. Katie, we're at the press conference for the Colorado Classic, so if there's any, like, talking in the background...
Yeah, I thought they were done with that.
I know. God, keep quiet, guys. So, Katie, we had some big news come down the other day, and that big news is that you signed on to Bulls Dolmans for 2019, biggest team in the women's peloton.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want to ask you a lot of questions about this, but first of all, like, how did this come together? How long had you been talking to them? What's sort of the backstory there?
Yeah. I've been talking to him for a little bit. Like, it just came, he got a hold of my contact and sent me an email around the time of Nationals, soon after I'd won California. And I think they're looking for another good climber to be able to support Anna in the hills and the mountains. And so, yeah, talk to me, and I think I can do that role pretty well. And I'm really excited to make that step. And also to just be part of this team that has just so much experience, so many good riders, like a really long track record of treating riders well and supporting them and kind of guiding their careers, trying to help them get the most out of their time in cycling. And
so this came as some news to me because I spoke to you at California. And the question there was about, hey, you know, what are you going to be doing next year? Do you want to go race in Europe? Do you want to keep racing in the States?
Yeah.
And the response I got from you then was like, you know,
I'm done.
I might be done. I kind of have a good thing going on in the States. So how would you describe, when we spoke in California, what was your attitude towards racing at that point?
I had just a good year in America this year, and I won 4 stage races in a row. And I think after you do that, it's kind of hard to come back and race that same calendar again, because it's hard to maybe even just repeat what you've just done, and you can't do any better. And so for me, I wasn't super excited about doing another American year, but when this opportunity came up, it's just so exciting, and it's such a new challenge and a new adventure for me, and it got me just my head back in the game. And I'm really excited about it.
Well, I remember part of it also being like, you know, the question was whether you wanted to go race in Europe full time. And it was like, well, I think I actually have a pretty good setup here in the States.
Yeah.
Wait, what's your setup like in the States?
I think I was just talking about being part of UHC, which is like just been a really wonderful place for me over the years. I've been here 5 years now, and I love my home. Like, I love my husband, I love my friends there, I love to train in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and to give all that up to go to Europe just seemed like too much. But we're working it out, me and my husband, trying to get him over there, trying to get me back home sometimes. and just like, yeah, the opportunities with this team specifically is a lot of what sort of changed my mind.
So looking in the crystal ball, what do you think your setup is going to look like next year? Have you picked a place in Europe? Have you scouted it out? Where are you going to be?
I think I'm going to live in Girona. I've never been there before. It just seems like a really nice place to be, a nice place to train. I think there's good riding, better weather than a lot of places in Europe, and just a lot of Americans and cyclists, and a nice place to sort of build a community.
Not a bad place. Yeah. We hear a lot of good feedback about Girona, yeah. So that makes sense. Another question I have for you is, you know, did this year's Giro Rosa play into it? I know that, you know, UHC did not get an invite to the Giro Rosa. We were all bummed about that. We wanted to see how you would do against some of the other top female climbers on races like the Zonkalan. First of all, what was it like for you to have to sit out that race?
It was a huge bummer. I guess we kind of had the consolation that we got a La Course invite, which was one, like 48 hours after the Giro ended, and is a pretty hard combo. And so I was really bummed to miss the Giro Rosa, but got to kind of be in France for a week before La Course, really stay focused on La Course, go into it less tired than I think some of the girls that raced the Giro were. And so, yeah, I really wanted to race that race. And I raced the Giro my first year pro, and it just kicked my ass. I've had just a lot of growth and experience since then. And I was really excited to go back and race it again. But, yeah, maybe next year. So
we have some really talented climbers at the top end of the sport right now. We have Annemiek van Vleuten, Ashley Mulman-Passeo, some of these, you know, Anna van der Breggen, riders who are really climbing quite well.
Really well.
Where do you see yourself currently stacking up against the top climbers?
I think I have the potential to be there with them. It's going to take a lot to kind of figure it out, just with positionings, racing in Europe, maybe getting to know the courses. Some of them have raced, you know, some of those races 10 times or more. I think I finished seventh in La Course, but I think I had a pretty bad race for myself, that I have potential to be up there in the top, but it's not going to be easy.
All right, my other Bulls Domus question for you is, let's take a time machine back to 2017, Amgen Tour California. Yeah. There were like elbows being thrown between UHC and Bulls Domus. I mean, you know, it doesn't sound like there are any hard feelings there, but like, what were your thoughts of the team coming out of that race? Seemed like they raced pretty aggressively.
Yeah, they were pretty aggressive, but it's all part of racing. And I can see that some of their domestiques are so loyal to their riders. And, you know, it sucks to be on the other side of it sometimes, but I get it when you're in a team like that.
So what are your long-term goals now with the sport? You know, you have this European contract. You're going to be racing overseas. Are you thinking 2019 now, or are you already thinking beyond?
I'm keeping the doors open. We'll see where it goes. I'm not good at making really long-term goals. I'm going to see how it goes next year and see if I like it and make the call from there.
Okay. Well, congrats again on the new team, and we'll be keeping an eye on you, Katie Hall, in 2019.
Thank you so much.
Chris, this year's Tour de France had some exciting moments. It also had some kind of funny moments, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. One that stands out, Nibali calling for the team car. Good old buddy Peter Sagan comes up, gives him a big old high five right on the side of the road.
Hey, buddy! That cracked me up. And you know what else I thought was kind of funny was when they did this fantasy prize on the broadcast for the Feedback Sports Sprint Repair Stand, Phil Liggett made some sort of comment like, well, that looks complicated. And it's like, okay, Phil, like, when's the last time you worked on a bike, man? I mean, all due respect to Phil Liggett, but this Feedback Sports Sprint Repair Stand is really simple, really straightforward to use. It's like a mini red anodized transformer, has 360-degree rotating platform, really secure front and rear mounting options. I don't know about you, Chris, but I've had really good luck using this stand to repair
my
bikes.
Yes, indeed.
So you don't have to be a pro mechanic to use this stand, but it's definitely used by pro mechanics on Trek Segafredo, Lotto Soudal, and Quickstep Floor. So check out FeedbackSports.com for more. And thanks to Feedback Sports for sponsoring this episode of the Velo News Podcast. On with the show. All right, guys, we got to wrap this up. We're going to do our usual off the front, off the back to close out the podcast today. And should I go first?
Or
you want me to go first?
Go for it. Absolutely.
Okay. All right, good. I am going to start with an off the front And my off the front is karaoke in the Peloton.
Mm.
Because my good friend Kiel Reinen, who races for the Trek Segafredo team, he did perhaps one of the most entertaining stand-up interviews for Tour Utah we've seen in quite a while, where he sang some of the famous song Jukebox Hero, and just he did it a cappella, which is not an easy thing to do with that track. And so kudos to Kiel for keeping the Peloton nice and musical. I dig it. And he's not the world's best singer, but he tries. He really tries.
he put a lot of effort
He really
into that.
Tries. Bless his heart. And his hair really does, it makes it. The long hair
the
makes
feather,
it.
Feather, too.
Okay. So my off the back is, I'm going to give the off the back to myself.
Ooh.
Because I started the Leadville Trail 100 mountain bike race basically at the very back of a group, of a field of like 1,500 people going into this 100-mile mountain bike race. I did it on, like we said earlier in the podcast, 1983 Specialized Stump Jumper. And the idea was just to kind of make a point that, you know, no matter what kind of bike you have, no matter whether you feel like your technology is outdated or you don't have the latest and greatest, you can still get out and ride and have a good time. You don't necessarily have to do Leadville, and maybe you shouldn't, but still, get out and ride, have fun. It doesn't have to be anything more complicated than that. And I'll tell you, I did have a great time at Leadville, even though I started off the back. I worked my way through a good deal of that field. And let me tell you, people hike a lot in that race, which is kind of crazy.
Did you place?
I think I think I was around 500th or something like that. So cool. I passed a lot of people.
Is that the lowest you've ever finished in a race?
Probably not.
Probably not. Okay.
I mean, I've definitely DNF'd. So, I mean, okay. That's
there
last,
you go.
Last place.
Sure.
But I don't think, I'm not sure if I've ever done a race with that many participants in it. I'm trying to think back to, I mean, you've done Dirty Kansas, Chris. So I got to think that's pushing over 1,500 people. It's a little under.
I can't remember. Can't remember.
All right. Well, off the back also is our math skills and number recollection for how
big
many
events.
Yeah, yeah. Recall is off the back here in the Velanese office, but that's nothing new. All right. Who's going next? They're off the front, off the back.
Yeah, sure. I'll take it. Okay. Let's go off the front. Singer-songwriters.
Oh, okay. Another musical one.
Yeah, Christopher Blavins, who recently I brought up.
Yes.
About 20 minutes ago in the podcast, earned himself his first World Cup podium on the mountain bike. Mont Saint Anne in Canada.
In the under 23 race.
In the U23 category. Good job, Chris Blevins, who, well, I guess I should point out, he likes to rap. He writes his own rap. That's the singer songwriter.
Check
connection.
It out.
He's very interesting, very talented guy. He wrote about it in the magazine a couple months ago.
Yeah, that's in the August magazine. Check it out.
Yeah, definitely check out Christopher Blevins. And then off the back, let's go with French Gorillas.
French Gorillas.
Yeah, Comment dit-on Gorilla. Anybody? Ooh. Anybody know that one? I don't know.
Man.
André Greipel taking a bit of a demotion, I guess you could say, going down from the World
Slipped
Tour.
Slipped on a banana peel.
Ooh. Nice man. I like André. Come on.
I do too.
Let's be nice.
Such a nice guy.
André's going to Fortuneo Samsic after a very long career with Lotto Soudal. He was kind of their star rider for quite a long time there.
Yeah.
And it's definitely a step down. Fortuneo, a team that has had trouble getting wins recently, not really shining very much in the Tour or even in the smaller World Tour races this year.
And a pro continental team at that.
That as well.
A little challenging for them to get all the invites they might need to put Greipel in front of the biggest racers in the world and that sort of thing. So,
I mean, he's 36 years old. He's definitely not what he was a year or two ago. At the same time, I mean, he's taken some wins this year. I could think of, several World Tour teams that could probably have used an upgrade in the sprinter category. So I don't know. It's probably
overpriced for his.
I was just going to say. I would imagine that Greipel probably wanted a little more than anybody wanted to give him. And so, we'll see how it goes for him.
But let's hope he keeps attacking at the Tour of Flanders early on.
I hope they get an invite because André Greipel in the Classics.
That's the best.
It's
something about André Greipel. He always attacks early at Tour of Flanders.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's
tradition.
Yes, it is. Okay, Chris, off the front, off the back.
Off the front, bunny hopping barriers.
Oh.
Yes, and not for men, for women.
Okay.
Ellen Noble, bunny hops barriers a year ago for the Behind the Barriers episode that she was doing with Jeremy Powers and their teammates. And lo and behold, she signs for Red Bull. And connect the dots. She's... A lot more to the story.
A little more to it than just bunny hop barriers.
Absolutely.
But big news.
Big news for her. Such an outspoken, eloquently opinionated in a way voice in cycling, and she's got a great stance on the women's place in cycling and action sports generally. So to sign for Red Bull, open up that platform for her, and allow her to do what she's been doing for years now through social media and Instagram and Twitter and all of that. It's a big deal for her. So.
And now she'll have a flat-brimmed Red Bull hat glued to her head for the rest of her life.
For the rest of her life.
But that's good money.
Absolutely. And off the back, U.S. Customs.
Oh.
Yeah, we're talking about Team Rwanda gets caught up in a little snafu at Dulles Airport on their way from Africa to the Colorado Classic, and several of their riders caught up in Dulles looking for a way to get out to Colorado by tomorrow, or Thursday, I should say.
Yeah, by the time you listen to this.
By the time you listen to this, hopefully they've made it into the state. The team has apparently new bikes waiting for them by bespoke maker Allied Bicycle Works. Beautiful new bikes they want to get their hands on, so they reached out for a private jet for any means they could find to get themselves to this state. So.
Well, Allied is based in Arkansas. Maybe you can pull some strings with the Walton family.
There you go.
The old Walmart private
Walmart
jet.
Walmart private jet.
Yeah. Well, see what happens.
Yep.
Well, guys, that was the Velo News podcast for this week. We've got the Colorado Classic coming up. Stay tuned to velonews.com for all the coverage from that 4-day race. And thanks for tuning in.